a manufacturer somewhere in the world who's produced a lot of genetically engineered foods that didn't work out right, they've got a lot in their hands, they can dump those on the United States market without so much as warning the, even informing the FDA that they're doing so. The, according to the FDA, they have no obligation whatsoever to do anything. Everything that they do is purely voluntary. Well, this is really a gross miscarriage of justice and really a dereliction of duty. And because by law, they're required to do a lot more than just give the FDA notice. By law, they're required to demonstrate in a very positive manner, demonstrate that every one of these foods is safe. The FDA has broken the law deliberately in order to enable genetically engineered foods to come to the market.
Genetically manipulated foods may be one of the most serious threats to not only our environment, but to the health and very survival of future generations. Hi, this is Dr. Mercola helping you take control of your health. And today we have Stephen Drucker, who you may not be aware of, but is the attorney who filed a lawsuit in the late 90s, last century, for the most important action the FDA has taken in this area, and that relates to the GRAS standards as it applies to genetically engineered foods, which is essentially the core, the foundational component that allows them to get away with this fraud. So we're going to explore all the different areas that are related to that because there's so many components to this. And Stephen has written a book called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, which doesn't really tell what it's about too much, but the subtitle does. And the subtitle is How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. So Stephen was aware of this issue 10 years before I was, and he's really a pioneer and a champion to warn the public and protect us from the negligence, the irresponsible actions the FDA has taken. So welcome, and thank you for joining us today, Stephen.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, and it's a pleasure to be talking with you.
So you were an early – you became aware of this. Actually, you know, as I mentioned earlier, 10 years ago I became passionate about this and have really – directed a lot of my efforts and resources to this struggle and fight to educate people and restrict the spread of GMO foods. But one of the – you know, how could you just how did you become aware – actually, what I wanted to say is that I was only superficially aware of the background that led up to the landmark rule that in 1992, which you filed your lawsuit – for the FDA on the GRAS equivalence of genetically engineered food. I had no idea of the academic and scientific discussion that was going on and that led up maybe up to 20 years prior, well, at least 15 years prior to that 1992 ruling. So how did you get, your book goes into that very carefully. So it gives it a nice historical record of what, the science that led prior to 92. Because normally you'd think it was, Michael Taylor's evilness that perpetuated this. Although he's a big factor, and we'll discuss that. There's other issues. So maybe if you can give us some of your background that led you to embark on this historic venture.
Well, I, as you said, became aware of these the problems of these foods several years before you did. I was still a bit behind the curve in terms of the whole genetic engineering venture. It was probably not till about late 94 or 95 that I became aware of genetic engineering itself, and also that it was being used by that point to reconfigure the genetic core of many of our foods, and that the ultimate goal was ultimately to reconfigure the genetic core of almost every edible fruit and vegetable and grain. That's the grand vision. I became very concerned as I learned about this, and I've had a long-term interest in eating healthful food myself, nutritious food, and in protecting the purity of the food. I was involved back in the late 1980s, in the campaign to better regulate food irradiation. But I have to say that I was also behind the curve on understanding what was going on with genetically engineered foods, which I think put things in perspective, because if somebody like me, who was so concerned about nutritious food, had been involved in food irradiation, still was somewhat blindsided up till about 1995, you can see why people like you and the average American still, up to a few years ago, didn't even know that he or she had been eating genetically engineered foods for all these years and feeding them unknowingly to their kids. So it really kind of, I think, has blindsided many of us. But when I did learn about it, at one point I had this feeling I need to learn more. I felt I might need to do something about it. I didn't know why, but when I began to do my research in 1996, it very quickly became apparent that there is a great gap, and there was at that time, there still is, but there was a great gap between the claims made by the proponents of genetically engineered foods and the actual facts. Even the preliminary reading made that very clear. And as I read more, I know a feeling kept welling up within me. Something has to be done to stop this, or at least to get it certainly stopped on the course it's proceeding, on which it's proceeding. Because one of the things that concerned me greatly, and you touched upon it already, is the fact that our own U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the agency that's supposed to be protecting the integrity of our food supply and upholding the food safety laws, which, by the way, are very strong in the United States. We'll get back to this, but it's very important to understand on the books, as a matter of statutory and regulatory record on the books, the United States probably has the strictest and most rigorous food safety laws in the world, stricter than the European Union. People don't realize that. The problem is they haven't been enforced when it comes to genetically engineered foods. Those foods have been basically given a way to evade the law, and it's been done through the FDA itself. And I know you'll want to go into that, and I certainly am prepared to pursue that in depth. But let's back up again. At the time, I was very concerned because the FDA had made a pretty much a blanket presumption in May of 1992 that genetically engineered foods were in principle generally recognized as safe, which meant, and then they said that meant that they could be marketed without any safety testing at all. That actually is incorrect, and we'll get into that. That actually is a blatant misrepresentation of U.S. food law. But that was the FDA claim. There's an overwhelming scientific consensus that they're safe, and so safe that they don't need to be tested, and therefore the FDA had let these foods onto our market without the requirement of a smidgen of testing. Moreover, they weren't even requiring that these foods be labeled so that consumers at least were informed about the major genetic reconfiguration that had occurred. Well, this struck me as not only being unscientific, but irresponsible and unethical. And at the time, I had a hunch it was also illegal. I hadn't done enough research then to know for sure, but as I did more research, that hunch was confirmed. Yes, that policy also is not only unethical and irresponsible, it's an out of line with science. It's contrary to our law. So, but even before I
knew it, and excuse me for interrupting, but you would know because you're an attorney.
I should. At the time, though, and our law is a huge field, so I hadn't specialized in food safety law, so I wasn't sure at the time, but I had a feeling it would be. Once I began extensive research, it became clear that the FDA had violated the law. But my feeling had been at that time that because I felt that the FDA's policy was so unscientific and irresponsible, there should be a lawsuit challenging it. And I did not envision myself at the time being an attorney involved in the suit because, as the introduction to my book explains, it goes through this history, I had spent most of my career doing public interest work but not really doing litigation and law of this type. And I didn't feel that I would be qualified for it. And I was also involved in an important project that I didn't want to get distracted from. So I was contacting public interest groups with the hope of inspiring them to do the lawsuit. Well, Everyone with whom I spoke was really thought the lawsuit was a great idea, but they didn't think it was a good idea for them to be doing it. For one reason or another, they said they weren't going to be able to do it. And eventually it became clear that if I didn't do it, it probably was not going to happen. So I put the project I was involved in on hold, and I founded a nonprofit organization called the Alliance for Biointegrity. I thought that name basically was apt for what I wanted to do, to uphold the integrity of the biosphere, really, uphold the integrity of life, biointegrity, and most people like that name. And I decided I'm just going to move ahead and start preparing for a lawsuit. And fortunately, as word got around and people started looking at the website, I was contacted by a very good public interest group in Washington, D.C., the International Center for Technology Assessment, and they had a very good legal team, and they were very interested in taking this on. And so we kind of worked out an arrangement where they would be the attorneys of record, and I would continue doing the main organizing for the lawsuit. And then I eventually became involved as an attorney on the case, too, and spent quite a lot of time in Washington, D.C., doing research, contributing to the documents that were contributed to the court. So the lawsuit, as you mentioned, was filed in May 1998, and it quickly accomplished something very major. In fact, the most major thing it did accomplish was it forced the FDA, through the discovery process, to hand over more than 44,000 pages of its internal files relevant to the policy it had made on genetically engineered foods. And that was a revelation, although it took a while going through all of that. But I assumed responsibility for going through that trove of documents, and it turned out being a treasure trove. There were amazing gems hidden within it, and they had hoped would remain hidden in it, because most of what was there was not all that interesting. But the memos from the FDA scientists who had been assigned to the biotechnology task force, and whose job it was to actually analyze and assess genetically engineered foods in terms of the law, in terms of science, and actually do a risk assessment. And this is probably one of the first scientific risk assessments performed by independent scientists. The memos that I was reading were astounding, because it wasn't surprising me to learn that they recognized that there were unusual risks to these foods. I already knew that. And I already knew that genetic engineering had the potential to create unexpected and unpredictable new toxins and allergens in these foods that would not be expected, could not be predicted, and would be very difficult to detect unless each food was subjected to very rigorous long-term testing, toxicological testing, the likes of which the biotech industry has routinely avoided performing and being given a pass on by various governments. But the surprising thing was not just that they understood these risks, but that they were warning about them in no uncertain terms to their superiors, and that what had happened is the decision makers at the FDA, who have admittedly, by their own admission, had been operating for years under a policy to promote the U.S. biotechnology industry, they decided that it was more important to promote the U.S. biotechnology industry and uphold the fragile image of genetically engineered foods rather than tell the truth and acknowledge the scientists' warnings. So what they did was they covered up those warnings, and if we hadn't brought the lawsuit, those warnings would probably still be laid covered up. We wouldn't know the extent to which the FDA has been lying all these years. But fortunately, we do know. And what we know is that although the FDA scientists overwhelmingly concluded and warned their superiors that these foods entail unique risks, they cannot be presumed safe, each one of them should be subjected to long-term rigorous toxicological testing, what we heard, what the public heard and the world heard from the FDA was that the agency, and this is almost an exact quote, the agency is not aware of any information showing that foods developed by these methods differ from other foods in any meaningful or uniform way. Now, it's impossible, I think, for any rational man or woman to read just the sampling of memos from the FDA scientists that are posted on the website of the Alliance for Biointegrity, that's at www.biointegrity.org, and then look at that statement by the FDA and feel that it's anything other than a blatant fraud meant to mislead the public, mislead the world, and allow genetically engineered foods a free pass onto the market. It's just an astounding fraud, and I think there probably is not a bigger fraud that has been committed by a U.S. regulatory agency than that one. There may be, but I would shudder actually to even see it. And we know that there have been a lot of hanky-panky on the part of administrative agencies. But this clearly, when one considers not only that for close to 20 years now, the American public has been exposed to these largely experimental, untested foods that its own scientists said entailed unique risks and could not be presumed safe, but that the FDA claimed that they could be presumed safe, that there was an overwhelming scientific consensus they were safe, when they knew that the overwhelming consensus of their own scientific experts that had been analyzing this issue thoroughly for more than a year was just the opposite. Also, it's very interesting, Dr. Mercola, I should point out, and this is in the book as well, that, and it's also on our website, it's document number 8, we've given them numbers, it's a letter from the FDA's biotechnology coordinator to an official with Health Canada, written in the fall of 1991, only about 6 months before the FDA released its public announcement saying that these foods could be presumed safe, that that there was an overwhelming consensus in the scientific community they're safe. Well, Dr. Mariansky's letter, as anybody can see, acknowledges that actually there is not a consensus about the safety of these foods in the scientific community. So that admission is in the FDA's own files. So even if we didn't have the memos from the scientists, we would have that admission. And yet what happens? The FDA basically just buries that and lies about it all. Now, as I mentioned, it's worse than the fact that just the American public has been subjected to these foods, because the FDA basically was the first government regulatory agency to make an official pronouncement about these foods, to take an official stance. And because the FDA, which is so respected, and because the U.S. government, the U.S., which is known to have strong food safety laws, came out with this decision about genetically engineered food, it actually paved the way for their easier treatment in Canada. In fact, Canada's given them essentially a free pass as well. But even in the European Union and many other countries, based on what the FDA did, it allowed them to do things that were very lax and still say, well, what we're doing is stricter than the U.S. Because they were doing anything would have been stricter than the U.S. since the FDA did not require anything from the industry. I don't know if you or your listeners are fully aware, but even today as we speak, a manufacturer somewhere in the world who's produced a lot of genetically engineered foods that didn't work out right, they've got a lot in their hands, they can dump those on the United States market without so much as warning even informing the FDA that they're doing so. According to the FDA, they have no obligation whatsoever to do anything. Everything that they do is purely voluntary. Well, this is really a gross miscarriage of justice and really a dereliction of duty. And because by law, they're required to do a lot more than just give the FDA notice. By law, they're required to demonstrate in a very positive manner, demonstrate that every one of these foods is safe. It's just as I've mentioned a few times, and I will keep repeating, the FDA has broken the law deliberately in order to enable genetically engineered foods to come to the market.
Well, thank you for that introduction and explanation as to the issue. The big core of the problem relates to the ruling, 1992 ruling on the grass issue. But I'm wondering if you could give a brief summary of the scientific discussion that actually occurred a decade or two earlier that led up to this, because this decision didn't come out of the thin air. I mean,
right.
I mean, you've highlighted the importance, and it's the foundational component that really allows this travesty to continue. But I think it's going to be helpful for this discussion to understand what led to that, and then how could these federal regulatory agencies be so manipulated, and the collusion with the media which follows. So. And then we can discuss what happened here at the lawsuit, too. So, but let's discuss about the historical precedents that led up to the 1992 sure. decision.
And I'm glad you're interested in learning more about it, because I think it's highly important. I was unaware of it before I started writing the book. And I started learning more, I realized, you know, there's a lot of backstory here that I want to know about and that I think is important. I decided that I wanted to do a book that actually made a major new contribution, did something none of the other books had done. There have been some very good books out there already. You featured some, you know, you featured some good books
sure.
and good writers. I wanted to, if I'm going to do something, I'd like to make a contribution that adds a lot to the story that hasn't been put out there before. So I started doing research about the early days of genetic engineering, long before the technology was even capable of producing a genetically engineered plant that could be eaten by consumers. It took a long time from developing genetically engineered bacteria before scientists could actually genetically engineer food plants and make them work, so make them viable. So back in the early era, when genetic engineering first became a reality back in the early 1970s, it was astounding. It really was a radical breakthrough. It was one of the, as Nobel laureate biologist George Wald, who was a professor at Harvard for many, many years, stated, it was the biggest break in nature that had occurred in human history. We've intervened in nature before, but according to him and according to many other scientists, this was by far the most radical human intervention into the natural order that had ever occurred. And even the scientists who were doing it were mindful of how radical it was and how important it was to be careful. And so initially, they themselves began to warn about the dangers of this new technology and how it had to be used very carefully. And again, remember, this was long before genetically engineered foods were able to be developed. But what they then realized was there was negative feedback from the public. The public got afraid. So little by little, and actually not so little by little as it turns out, they began to change their story. And then it became clear that they had to project a united front of confidence about this. And so what we began to see was a progressive misrepresentation campaign that often shaded into downright disinformation on the part of several scientists to convince the public and the government that genetic engineering is something that is essentially not very different than processes that have been occurring in nature all along anyway, that the initial discussions, the initial pronouncements that it's something very radical and new were actually misguided, mistaken, that this is something somewhat benign and nature's doing it anyway, so there shouldn't be any worries. And they got away with that. There was a major lobbying campaign, I believe it was the summer of 1976, either that or 77, that even major universities were participating in. One of the biggest lobbying campaigns, probably the biggest lobbying campaign ever mounted by the scientific establishment to convince the congressmen in Washington that there was no need for legislation, because at that time several bills to regulate genetic engineering had been introduced in Congress, and one that had been introduced by Senator Edward Kennedy was very promising. That one was almost sure to be passed. But this concerted lobbying effort, and that also relied on misinformation, and the book goes into the history of how that misinformation was generated, claims that evidence existed that didn't exist.
Well, who was behind the lobbying efforts back then? Because clearly it wasn't traditional biotech that we have now.
Did you say who was behind the effort?
Yeah, who was behind the lobbying efforts back then?
One that's very interesting and that I emphasize in the book, it was not the biotechnology industry.
Couldn't be. They weren't
they
around.
Weren't around, and that's very important, and that's a key theme of the book, that the biotechnology industry, as irresponsible as they have been by and large, the main guilt lays really at the feet of the mainstream molecular biology establishment. The scientists who were doing the research, getting the grants, wanting to develop this technology, and again, most of them had altruistic goals. They thought this was going to be able to be used to cure so many ills in the field of medicine. Back then, food, they thought maybe it could be used in food and that would be important. Back then, it was more for applications for health and medicine. And they thought it was going to have so many boons. But there was also some financial conflict of interest on the part of many of them. But for several, there wasn't. But I think they eventually developed an ends justifies the means psychology. And that's very easy to do. I probably have fallen into that trap myself at times. But when you have so many highly influential, powerful scientists that are working together to convince the world that genetic engineering is inherently safe, and what they're doing, and that the research they're pursuing is safe, that actually can be somewhat dangerous, and it turned out being very dangerous for the world, I think, because one of the points that's made in the book very clearly, and it's surprising, is the burden of proof that existed at the NIH on new technologies, new products like this, that ordinarily places the burden on the developer to substantiate the safety of the new technology and its products, got shifted. And it got shifted because of the subterfuge and the fraud, and put on the shoulders of the critics, the people who had concerns. And there were many good scientists who had concerns, but they were all of a sudden put in the position of, you've got to prove they're dangerous, and the burden of proving safety was removed. Now,
well, and how do you think that that particular subgroup was able to attain prominence over the ones that were warning and expressing the caution should be exercised? Because there was obviously some of in both camps.
Yes, there were. It may well be that I think it was, and that the ones that were pitching the promise of this technology were the ones that were supported, that had the most support from the major research universities, from the co-discoverer of the DNA structure of DNA, James Watson, referred to as the molecular biology establishment. By the way, he did not do that in a disparaging way. He was a member of that establishment and one of the big boosters of genetic engineering and one of the people who started claiming very strongly that it was safe and that all of the earlier concerns were really overblown and should have never been circulated. And so the molecular biology establishment had great power. And as my book brings out, the molecular biologists that were strongly in favor of pushing ahead with genetic engineering without adequate safeguards had quite a bit of power at the National Academy of Sciences. And that group, that's really our nation's premier scientific organization. And this book goes into it, gets some behind-the-scenes stories showing that the National Academy of Sciences, the NAS, because their agenda was so strongly influenced by powerful molecular biologists and that establishment, they were afraid of allowing for a full and fair review of the possible ecological problems of releasing genetically engineered organisms. And it took a lot of effort on the part of Dr. Philip Riegel, an eminent biologist who at the time was a professor at the University of Minnesota, to kind of break through and finally get funding so there could be a scientific conference at which ecologists and the scientists that specialized in environmental issues could talk with the molecular biologists and interact and try to educate them as to the risks that were inherent in what they were doing. And the National Academy of Science, not only had they tried to stop something like that from happening, once it was going, they tried to actually co-opt it. But Dr. Riegel rebuffed them. Dr. Riegel, by the way, was one of the plaintiffs in our lawsuit and has been one of the greatest supports for me in writing the book, because when he became aware I was writing my book, he actually came down to where I live to meet with me. And after discussions, he said, "I like the way you're doing this." He said, and he was really the point man attempting to get the genetic engineering venture much more in line with sound science during probably the first 15 to 20 years of its existence. He was active for many, many years. And he said, "I was keeping a lot of my notes and observations. I was going to put it into a book myself at some point." He said, "I'm getting close to retirement. I have many other projects that I need to finish." He said, "I may never get around to it, but I like what you're doing. And if you want to use them, I will give them to you." So when he did that, it was a gold mine. It allowed me, as you have noticed in what you've read, it allowed me to interweave his fascinating story in with the story I was telling, and make it a much more exciting, compelling narrative. So he made a major contribution. Dr. Philip Riegel is a great hero. He is one of the, not too many people know about him yet. Hopefully through my book, he will get all of the respect and gratitude from the public and the world that he deserves. I think he should be given a National Medal of Science at the minimum. He has performed such a great service to science and to the cause of food safety that I think it's almost an inestimable contribution that Dr. Riegel has made. A great personal sacrifice, actually. He's had to go through a lot to do it. And there are many other great heroes, too. But I do want to mention him. So Dr. Riegel, broke, and some of his collaborators broke through. They had a major conference. It was shocking when they learned just how many high-risk projects that the genetic engineers had in the pipeline and slated for imminent release that only got stopped because Phil Riegel actually got that conference going. And then another one, a follow-up in Philadelphia about a year later, at which he was the keynote speaker. And because of those two conferences, that created enough of a pushback that at least a lot of those high-risk projects were stopped. Otherwise, there could have been major ecological disasters. And the world still came close to a few, and there might have already been a few of which we're not yet aware. But at least some of the very worst were stopped because of that. And a more rational policy in terms of the environmental side was instituted. But I have to qualify that, only more rational in terms to nothing, because it's still
it's all relative.
As the seventh chapter of my book demonstrates, there's been huge erosion of environmental protection in this country and many other countries, and great risk put on our environment by genetically engineered foods. So, but then Dr. Riegel, when he began thinking about food safety, realized that was even a bigger, there were bigger risks involved there than in the environment, and he began to focus more on the food safety issue. And the book discusses that as well.
So it sounds like, we'll have to get Dr. Riegel on for an interview too, because I would certainly like his perspective.
Right.
But it sounds like that he was one of a minority of scientists in the molecular biology community, which were those voices were eventually outweighed by the others who had probably some financial conflict of interest, and eventually developed a technological elite in this area.
That's true. And I bring out in the book that when President Dwight Eisenhower, in his farewell address, warned not only about the military-industrial complex, but he warned about the danger that there could be the growth of a scientific technological elite, that actually was prescient. He was being prophetic there, because that is what happened in regard to the molecular biology establishment and the biotech establishment. That did happen, and they were able to play the media, and the, even back then, the media began to give very imbalanced coverage. And so, as my book points out, even then, and it has become increasingly worse over the years, the media tended to present all of the statements about how good these foods were and safe they were in the mouths of the scientific experts. And any time that there was concern raised, they would put that in the mouth of non-scientists, activists, who, you know, generally were presented as not knowing very much about science, but just were concerned. So they really had a very imbalanced way of presenting this, because there always have been a large number of well-credentialed scientists who were concerned about it. They just lacked the financial power, the academic institutional power, because the universities were getting behind this. There was so much research money coming into it, for one thing. So, in fact, scientists at universities who spoke out voiced their concerns. If they didn't have tenure, they probably wouldn't get it. And even if they had tenure, they were punished in various ways. But, you
know, and that's true to this very day.
It is, and it's been. So what you've had was science has been very badly distorted, very badly subverted. That's why I use that word in the subtitle of my book. There's been a tremendous subversion of science that has gone on, ironically, in the name of science. The people who are promoting
the ultimate irony.
Yeah, there's so many ironies in this one. It's really kind of like the comedy of the absurd. So what did happen was, it was the prevailing of the elite that had the power, had the ability to manipulate the press, and they basically were successful in promulgating the impression that there were no real problems with genetic engineering, that there was an overwhelming scientific consensus this was so, and that there never has been a scientific consensus about that, and that again, regulation wasn't really needed, that they had it, that they could be trusted, they were regulating it very well, and that regulation was unnecessary. And they essentially kept regulation at a bare minimum.
Well, that's important to know, because that really is the foundation that set up the framework for that 1992 ruling. I mean, if this didn't exist, it wouldn't have happened.
Right.
They couldn't have pulled it off.
Right. And I'm glad you brought up that point, because I'm going to repeat it again. It's so important. And I emphasize it in the book. If that fraudulent groundwork hadn't been laid by the mainstream scientific establishment, especially the molecular biology establishment, as you say, the FDA could not have done what it did. Its fraud could not, it wouldn't have had the aura of scientific respectability, nor could what Monsanto and the biotech industry have later been able to do. They couldn't have done it either. So the primary blame, the primary guilt, goes back to the early 1970s, to the molecular biologists who were little by little fudging things, fudging facts, spin doctoring, and this is my book says, eventually spin doctoring kind of crossed the line to downright misrepresentation. And not every scientist who's even dispensed misinformation may even realize that he or she has done so, because many of them have believed what they hear other people saying. And so, as Philip Riegel mentions, and I quote him in there, within the scientific community, gossip became as good as truth, you know, as good as fact. And people just parroted what they heard other people saying. It's very unfortunate.
Well, thank you for revealing this, because it's important to know how we got to the point where we are today. And so it sounds like this combination of, at the time, a relatively mild financial conflict of interest, but more importantly, combined synergistically with this human frailty of a tendency of human nature to ultimately think they know better.
Right.
You know, so that combination just morphed into this technological elite, which dictated the policy.
I have at times said that it turned out becoming a combination of arrogance and avarice. And as we know, that's not a marriage made in heaven.
No. And the sad reality is that it's going to cause a lot of challenges and grief and unnecessary deaths and suffering.
That's the problem. It could have been doing that already, and as we can discuss later,
we know
that it hasn't been killing people. In fact, we do know that a genetically engineered food supplement did kill many people.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go next, because that happened in the 80s. You know, I'm sure you're talking about L-tryptophan,
right?
Which most people, maybe even today, didn't even realize was a result of genetically engineered. One of the first major genetically engineered catastrophe. And I experienced that because I was a practicing physician. I used to prescribe L-tryptophan for my patients, or tryptophan for, you know, as a sleeping aid and for depression. And it became unavailable, and the FDA spun this whole thing, as I'm sure you're going to describe, and actually used it as a tool and leverage against dietary supplements.
Right. It's really, you know, not only did they commit fraud about genetic engineering, they used that as leverage to go against products they knew were safe, or they had good reason to believe were safe, and blamed, you know, they blamed a disaster that had been created that appears to have been created by genetic engineering on L-tryptophan supplements themselves, which never had created a problem prior to the genetically engineered version of L-tryptophan. And, you know, we're being prescribed by physicians such as yourself. They had a safe history, and the scientific evidence is very clear. Tryptophan supplements were not a problem. The only, to our knowledge, the only tryptophan supplement that ever created a problem was the one that had been created through genetically engineered bacteria. And as my book demonstrates, when one gathers all of the evidence we have and puts it all together, then the finger gets pointed pretty strongly at the genetic engineering technology itself as having been the cause for the toxic contamination that caused a major epidemic in 1989 and 1990. And again, dozens of people were killed, thousands were seriously sickened, and of those, hundreds are probably still invalids and do not live a normal life. And that's because they consumed a product of genetic engineering.
And I definitely want you to go into details of how and why this happened, and the progress, you know, the time it took to figure this thing out. And the reason I think it's so important to review this here is that it's so clear to me, the writing is on the wall. These companies are going to use this as a template for the disasters that are going to happen, that are going to occur in the future. And they're going to follow the same damn strategy they did back then. So I think it's important to learn from history. And why don't you review with us how long it took, and how the misrepresentation and the fraud continued for over a decade.
Yes. You know, your point is so good. That's one reason I decided to make this book much longer than I initially envisioned, because I wanted the history to be there. I wanted it to all be known, so that the narrative that they're spinning cannot really survive, hopefully will not survive, and that they cannot use it as a template, as you said, and we know they would. You're right. If we don't get the knowledge out there, then they will be able to continue the same game plan. And it's very important to get the truth out there so that it cannot continue into the future, so that changes are made. Dramatic changes have to be made. And what happened was, actually, beginning in the probably mid-1980s, one of the main developers of genetically of L-tryptophan supplements, and the main manufacturers were all in Japan. One of them, Showa Denko Corporation, had decided that they could probably churn out more L-tryptophan in the same amount of time if they endowed the bacteria they were using to do it with extra genes. Because the bacteria had the genes to the genetic components to synthesize L-tryptophan. But they thought, what if we give the bacteria an extra copy, or maybe a couple extra copies, of those genes so that they can pump it out more quickly? And actually, it may have only ended up being one extra copy. At this point, I don't remember for sure. So let's just assume it was just an extra copy. But then they learned that in order to get that to work properly, they had to actually soup it up with a promoter from a virus. We don't need to go into all that right now. But let's just say it was an unnatural situation, because not only they were giving it an extra genes that it did not ordinarily have, but they were cranking them up to overproduce. And it's well known that any time a protein is forced to be overproduced within a living organism, you can have imbalances, you can have problems. And bacteria and plants do something that people and animals don't, because we can move around. You know, we have other ways of defending against predators. But bacteria and plants, well, plants are immobile, bacteria are immobile, but they still have to have weapons because they're fairly simple. So they're called secondary metabolites, and many of them are really beneficial to us, antioxidants, but they can be very harmful if they're produced, if some of them could be, or if they're produced in too much quantity or whatever. But very strange new product, chemical products, can be produced if you start messing around with the metabolism of bacteria. And that's what Showa Denko was doing. They were messing around in very radical, unprecedented ways with the metabolism of the bacteria that had been safely used for many, many years. Now, what happened, it appears, is that even before the epidemic that was caused, there was some toxic contamination in their product, which began to give people trouble, probably 86, 87. And as they increasingly, records show, as they increasingly increased, ramped up the production of L-tryptophan, the product seems to have become increasingly toxic, till the final version they had, which was the most souped up of them all and really was most disruptive, it seems, to the metabolism of the bacteria, cranked out not only a lot of L-tryptophan, but some unusual contaminants. And the profile of that toxic tryptophan was highly unusual in that it contained many more contaminants than most products do. They were at a very low level, though. It was still pure according to pharmacological standards. So it tested pure. Generally, most chemicals are not dangerous at that extremely low concentration, but at least one of those was, and it created a major epidemic. Now, one of the points that is very sobering is this epidemic, even though it was very difficult to determine, and it took some time to discern, it only was determined because the symptoms were highly unusual and unique. If it had been a common malady, such as more cancer or colitis or asthma, we wouldn't know about it still, because it wouldn't have been enough of an increase against the ordinary baseline for us to even know. So it was fortuitous, in a sense, that it was such a strange disease. Otherwise, it would not have been even recognized, and those tryptophan supplements would still be marketed and still be killing and maiming people. And it's a very important thing to know.
I think they gave the name EMS, wasn't it?
Yes, dubbed it EMS.
Eosinophilic myalgic syndrome, I believe.
Good, I'm glad you pronounced it.
Yeah. I've never saw a case, but you know, that was clearly in the news back then.
Yeah. And so again, even with that, then once it became clear that and it took a lot to trace back all the different supplements, because they had different brand names, to the different manufacturers to find out which supplements have been causing this epidemic. And every supplement that had been linked to the epidemic had been manufactured by Showa Denko, the only manufacturer that was employing genetic engineering to crank out higher volumes of L-tryptophan. When that became known, the reaction, the kind of damage control kicked in on the part of all of the various proponents of genetically engineered food, including our Food and Drug Administration, which clearly is one of the biggest cheerleaders for it, and had already, actually that was before their May 1992 policy, but they, even back then in 1990-91, they showed they were quite willing to suppress evidence and to dispense misinformation in order to protect the image of genetic engineering. And they did that very effectively, unfortunately, as did the rest of the scientific establishment that was supporting genetic engineering. And so powerful and persistent and successful has the misinformation that's been dispensed on behalf of clearing the L-tryptophan clearing genetic engineering from having caused the toxic contamination, that, as my book brings out, as of today, most people and even a large percentage of scientists don't even know that an epidemic was caused by a genetically engineered food supplement. That's clear. That's why I call the chapter, the relevant chapter, Disappearing a Disaster, because for practical purposes, that disaster has been disappeared for most of the world. Now, for the smaller percentage of people who know that there was a disaster and know that it was in some way linked to a genetically engineered food supplement, for them, the claims have come out that the evidence has been evidence has proven that genetic engineering was not involved, that it was some defect in the manufacturing process independent of genetic engineering. That is not true. And my book, you know, very carefully establishes why that's not true and why, even with all of the evidence that was available before I began doing my research, it was more likely than not that genetic engineering had caused the problem. And that if actually the question of whether genetic engineering had been at fault had been a matter adjudicated in the U.S. or British legal system, then it probably would have been held liable, because all you need to do is show the preponderance of evidence points in that direction. And even before I started my research, that was the case. But I did something further. I actually gave a call to one of the scientists who had been for years a professor at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He and his colleagues had been studying very carefully this epidemic. They wanted to know about it. They wanted to try to discern why it happened. And I knew that they had been researching one of the toxic contaminants that was most significantly linked with the epidemic, but whose scientific profile had not yet been, chemical profile had not been identified. And I wanted to find out what progress he might have made that I didn't know about and others didn't. And he and I developed a lot of conversations. He actually drove to where I lived to talk more about it. And when he became comfortable with the approach I was taking, what I was doing, he said, I will basically allow you to be the first to publish the results of our research, what we found. So that's a first within the book. And what it shows is that with their research, excuse me, that case-associated compound chemical that is most significantly linked with the epidemic was almost surely to have been produced by the bacteria before the L-tryptophan went into the purification process. In other words, and if it was produced within the bacteria or by enzymes, and it's almost certain, he said, that it was produced by enzymes, that bacterial enzymes, probably within the bacteria itself, possibly in the broth before it was put through the purification system. But in either event, that means that it is very, very likely that it was genetic engineering that caused the problem, that caused the disruption. And there are many other reasons based on its profile why we are led to believe that. So if we add that evidence in with what we already knew, then the case against the genetic engineering becomes very strong indeed. Now, I have to make sure, and I do this in the book, it's not conclusive proof. There's still a slight possibility that genetic engineering didn't cause it, but the odds are now very, very strong that it did. And for the official story to be either that there wasn't an epidemic related to genetic engineering, or that there was a bacteria that was created by it, but the genetic engineering had been shown scientifically not to have anything to do with it. It's really unfortunate that those are the main narratives that have been out there, and that's what most people think.
Sure, that's the misrepresentation, but hasn't this understanding scientifically that the genetic engineering was a high probability in this case, known before 1992?
It was known before 1992. Certainly the strongest case wasn't known, but the FDA knew before 1992 that genetic engineering could not be ruled out as the cause of that epidemic. And in fact, when I got a hold of their files, one of the interesting documents was a memorandum written by the FDA's biotechnology coordinator summarizing a meeting he had just had with the government accounting office, which was actually looking into the L-tryptophan tragedy, the MS epidemic. And when they interviewed him, he couldn't really flim-flam them the way the FDA had been flim-flamming the general public and even Congress a lot. And he says there in his memo that he acknowledged to them that the genetic engineering could not be ruled out. So they knew that it could not be ruled out. Therefore, they had to, and because the burden of proof should have been against that supplement, that's the matter of law, should have been presumed guilty anyway, but he knew that it couldn't be ruled out as a matter of science. And yet, if you look at the FDA's official statements, as I bring and I bring out many of those in the book, you won't get that flavor. It's that it's not only that it cannot be ruled out. Several of them are that it wasn't involved at all. That was the testimony of one of the FDA officials to Congress, where he blamed it all on food supplements, on these new food supplements, on health food supplements, and didn't even use the word genetic engineering. None of these congressmen even had an inkling if they hadn't done outside research. So it's really atrocious. The FDA knew enough in May of 1992 to know that there was doubt had been cast on the safety of genetic engineering because of that incident.
And it's just another factor that you can add to the leads to their lack of credibility and essentially fraudulent representation in their ruling in 1992.
Right.
Which is why it's so important, because there was this massive genetically engineered catastrophe that they knew about and denied. They were in absolute denial and were able to get away with it because even up until recently, you know, when we started the campaigns for labeling GMO foods in the West Coast, none of the public knew what a GMO food was.
That's right.
So they may have heard of genetic engineering, but they certainly didn't know it applied to food. So you can imagine 20 years previously that a congressperson would be aware of this. You wouldn't be.
Yeah. And by the way, since you brought up that subject about the campaigns to get labeling, I want to commend you for the major role you've played. You've been such a benefactor to that, and it's really admirable. And I just want to commend you.
Well, it's the least I could do. I mean, this is an important issue that really...
Well, you could have done a lot less. You could have done a lot less, but fortunately for the world, you didn't. And again, you deserve a lot of thanks and gratitude.
Well, I've got a great team too, but you know, I'm passionate about this issue, and I'm one of my biggest regrets is that I didn't become passionate about it earlier, like you did. You got me beat by 10 years, so you know, and I'm grateful that you were there helping protect the public. So let's continue with the story, and I think that you know we've covered the EMS tragedy enough. I mean, if we want more details, there's certainly plenty
but
in the book.
On that, just one after
sure.
afterward, and it's so gross that you will hear. Both from governments around the world and who are promoting this and from scientists, a claim that no genetically engineered food has ever been associated with a human health problem. One government official has stated not so much as a sneeze or a sniffle has ever been associated with a product of genetic engineering. What? There was a major epidemic. So that's why I say essentially it was disappearing a disaster, because that is the basic story that's out there right now.
Yeah, and it's just amazing that they were able to get away with this. So, you know, that's something that we have to bring up because history is so important in that, in, you know, in any discipline, but certainly in it relates to genetically engineered foods. And that's why your book is such an important piece of work to help provide the framework to, for that historical perspective. So, you know, again, this the whole issue of that 1992 GRAS ruling is central to how they're being able to get away with this fraud and this misrepresentation. And I'm, you know, let me just talk about Michael Taylor for a bit because people have heard about him before. And 5 years before he worked as an FDA attorney for 5 years before he became a private practice attorney for a firm that represented Monsanto. And then he got promoted to be deputy commissioner for policy right around this time of 1992. But then let me just comment, because I won't go back to him later, what he did so after
1991.
That. It was 1991.
So where they were trying, the FDA was trying to actually get its final policy put into shape. So he came on board to really put that
in 91,
into
right.
shape.
Yeah, so he was there, and then he was rewarded for that because actually, I guess he went back to Monsanto as a vice president for public policy.
In the Washington, D.C. office. Essentially,
yeah,
chief lobbyist.
Then in 2009, he goes back to the FDA as a senior advisor on food safety, or the food czar, and now deputy commissioner for foods. So just the most blatant example of a revolving door policy that, you know, should not be allowed to exist. But why don't you comment on his participation in this process? Because he seems to play a key role, but maybe not as big a role as this technological elite that allowed him to implement it. Because there's this transition from the technological elite to the merger of this massive corporate financial interest. Because it was relatively minor before; it was just government funding for the most part, which is still big but not huge. And hopefully, you know, more objective. But certainly corporate funding is an objective anyway. Its main mandate is to maximize profits.
Right.
So at some point, discuss how the industry got into there. You know, when did they start doing the research for agriculture and their investments and then how Taylor got merged into this process? And because it's an interesting story.
Right. It's a good question. I may not be able to provide every specific date, but we do know, my book makes clear that more than 9 years from the creation of the first genetically engineered bacterium to the creation of the first genetically engineered food product. And even then, that wasn't a product that could be marketed. Actually, it was the first genetically engineered plant. It wasn't even a food plant. And so, but it was somewhere probably in the early 1980s, maybe 79, that big corporations started to become interested in the potential applications of genetic engineering to agriculture. And Monsanto seems to have been one of the first. And it began, in fact, it invested, I can't remember the figure, my book quotes a figure of how much money was invested by Monsanto in research on this before it had one marketable product at all. Now, that's important because if that
is billions of dollars.
If that preliminary groundwork we discussed earlier by the scientific community had not been laid, Monsanto would not have, and the burden of proof hadn't already been shifted, Monsanto probably would not have gone ahead to invest all that money, but the groundwork had been laid for them. That's why I say that early history is so important, because Monsanto did invest so much, but we know that big, powerful interests have a lot of clout in our political system, and that the regulatory agencies can become captured by the very industries they're supposed to regulate. And the case of the biotech industry, and in particular Monsanto, it appears that the capture has become almost essentially complete. Whereas, you know, to a large, actually, when you think about this, and you mentioned the point, but again, I'd like people to consider, here you've got a man who was a partner at a major Washington, D.C. law firm representing Monsanto, not just Monsanto, but the International Food Biotechnology Conference or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. So obviously planning the legal strategy for the main purveyors of genetically engineered food, and he becomes the one to become deputy commissioner of policy at the FDA, which, by the way, was created just for him. That post hadn't existed before, and it was because, I think, as I looked through the records, you have the FDA scientists who are objecting to the drafts of the policy statement. Wait, what's happening to all the scientific elements in this? This is beginning to read just like an industry, you know, document. You know, it reads like it was created by industry. Well, it actually was, at least created by the desires of the industry. So I believe, this is my belief, that Michael Taylor was brought in at that critical junction to start getting things moving in the direction that the Bush White House and the people directing the FDA wanted. But certainly we can see within the memos there, and my book shows how memos could come from the Office of Management and Budget just a few days, a short, maybe a few weeks before the policy was released. They were enacted, change the title, change these, whereas the efforts of the scientists rarely got implemented. And if they did, then they got excised usually. Or if they did make any change, it took so long. So you can see where the clout was. It was coming from the White House, and the Office of Management and Budget. The economic, political considerations were trumping the scientific considerations. And the poor FDA scientists, they were spending their time trying to do their job as scientists, and it turned out it didn't come to anything. Well, actually, it did. Because of the lawsuit, I was able to bring out to the world what they actually did say as scientists. But if that lawsuit hadn't happened, we still wouldn't know. All of their work would have been completely for nothing. But at least now we can juxtapose what they said against what the administrators and the Office of Management Budget wanted to be said. And we can see who had science on their side and who, although they had no scientific backing, carried the day because of the power, the political and economic power.
Yeah, it seems one of the other variables or the factors that facilitated this from occurring was, and people listening to this may remember that back in the 80s in the Reagan and the Bush administration, there was this whole movement, and much of the country was aligned with it, of decreasing federal regulations to not burden the corporations and industry and impair our ability to be successful financially. So there's all this deregulation process that was part of it. But they threw the baby out with the bathwater because that's one of the few functions the federal government's supposed to do is to protect the public.
Right. But my book goes into this and shows how the molecular biology establishment was very fortunate in that when Reagan came in, their deregulatory agenda dovetailed with his. So it fit very well with it, and it made it even easier from that standpoint to start rolling back or at least get the move to roll back regulations. But as I point out in the book, the irony, and you actually just essentially said it yourself, the irony is when Reagan's successor, George H.W. Bush, was in the White House, that's when the policy, the FDA's policy came out, but it was a continuation of the Reagan policy from the 80s. The FDA, Reagan had said no new regulation, no new laws. The fact was they were stuck with a law that was already on the books and had been since 1958, that according to that law, genetically engineered foods would have to be demonstrated safe. They couldn't be presumed safe ahead of time. Each one. So that's why the FDA had to break that law and had to pretend that it didn't exist. So when Vice President Dan Quayle announced the FDA's policy, he announced it as regulatory relief for the industry and said that we're freeing the industry from any new burdensome regulations. What he didn't know was the industry was also being freed from a law that had been on the books since 1958 and was one of the major consumer protection laws that was being illegally circumvented. So that was in the name of deregulation. We were having illegal activity.
Yes, indeed. So, and that's the crux of it. This illegal activity has allowed them to perpetuate and increase their penetration into the market. So, you realized this in the late 90s, and you earlier discussed your interest in it and involvement with the lawsuit. So why don't you give us an update on what happened with the lawsuit? Because it's a really great story as to what happened and how you got sabotaged and, you know, and all that massive effort that went to derail you in the process and the whole lawsuit and then the subsequent appeals, which is even more interesting.
Yeah, well, I will be happy. Well, it's, you know, I've got enough distance from it now and I'm laughing. It is like another, it's like the theater of the absurd. but it happened through a federal district court in Washington, D.C., which, you know, is supposed to be one of the top rate judicial fora in the United States.
Oh, before you go in, I had a question for you that kind of that sets the frame for this. Because the judge that was responsible, I think it was a female judge, was responsible
yes.
for this ruling.
Yes.
And is that judge appointed or was yes. she elected or how does it? Because oh. that, I mean, her, she has such, her views on this were central to the whole thing. And it really, I don't remember reading how that she got to be there and what her influence
was. I don't think I brought that out in the book, but federal judges are appointed by the president, actually. And then, of course, the Senate has to confirm the appointments. And interestingly enough, this judge had been appointed by President Clinton. And I can't remember exactly what year, but so she hadn't been serving earlier than 1993. And might have only been serving from later than that. So she was a Clinton appointee, and you know, she had a good academic background, and some of her other decisions seem to have been pretty good ones. But this one, I think it's difficult for anybody who understands law, or even people who don't, but who can think clearly, to read actually the actual account of what happened to think that her decision was actually a sound one that deserves respect. Because basically, and you can stop me if I'm going, I'll just try to give the main details that I think people need to know to appreciate
sure.
what happened and the absurdity really of what happened and what didn't happen, is that in such a suit, our challenge, and it's under the administrative procedure rules, so there are technicalities involved. The judge tried to pare them down to the most picayune technicality, and I'll get back to that, but essentially, there didn't need to be a trial in this case, because trials are only necessary when there's a dispute about material facts. Trials are done to try to figure out, you've got parties saying, this happened, no, he said this, no, I didn't say that. So trials are done to clarify the facts. In our case, as a matter of law, really, the critical facts were just the facts that the FDA had within its own record as of May 1992 when it released its policy. At least that's the way the judge interpreted it. So if those are the key facts, then there was no need to have a trial because both the FDA and we agreed on what those facts were. We both had copies of the record. So at that point, you go on a motion for summary judgment, which means the judge, you make arguments to the judge based on these facts. Here's why we should prevail as a matter of law. And each side submits briefs. We submitted an initial brief. Then the FDA submits an answer. We answer their answer. They answer ours. And then there's another round of answers. Now, the judge ordinarily in such a case would have called for oral arguments to pursue things in more depth. And we fully expected that she would, but surprisingly, she didn't. And when she finally issued her opinion, it was a bit of a stunner, because what she stated was that essentially, in May of 1992, the FDA administrators had some rational basis to presume that genetically engineered foods are generally recognized as safe. That was the key legal issue. There were some other ones, but the main issue was the presumption the FDA made that, in principle, genetically engineered foods are generally recognized as safe. Can that stand? We had a high burden. We had to show that that was an arbitrary and capricious breach of administrative discretion arbitrary and capricious. So as long as the FDA could show there was some rational basis for that decision, they could be upheld. Because a judge doesn't put him or herself in the place of the administrator and say, well, I would have done it differently. The criterion is, was there some rational basis? Well, in our case, we demonstrated there wasn't, that actually, for a number of reasons, because according to the law and the FDA's own regulations, in order to be generally recognized as safe, an additive or supplement has to fulfill two basic criteria. One of them is there has to be solid technical evidence of safety that has been generally known within the scientific community, and that ordinarily means, according to the FDA's own regulations, that evidence should have been published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal so its solidity can be certified. And not only that, then there has to basically, well, if that happens, that means that there should have been a consensus within the scientific community. But there has to be an overwhelming consensus that the product is safe, and that consensus has to be based on solid technical evidence. Now, the FDA's own files show that in the case of genetically engineered foods, neither of those conditions applied. In fact, their files show that, again, just the opposite, that there was certainly a major dispute about the safety of these foods, even within the FDA. Most of their scientific staff said you can't presume they're safe. So that right there is a scientific fact, that it's a fact, a material fact. But also, as I mentioned, there was that letter from the FDA's own biotechnology coordinator admitting that there wasn't a scientific consensus. Now, by the way, we shouldn't have even had to base it on what was in the record, because the judge acknowledged that the evidence we brought in when we filed the suit, and one of the primary pieces of evidence, was that we had 9 well-credentialed life scientists who took the unprecedented step of signing the complaint as plaintiffs. They became plaintiffs in our lawsuit. That was unprecedented for a group of scientists to be suing a federal regulatory agency on the basis that one of its policies is scientifically unsound. And right there, by doing that, we demonstrated there was not general recognition of safety within the scientific community.
And it wasn't just one or two scientists, it was a dozen.
We had not. Nine? And of course, as my book points out, in earlier years, the FDA had driven a supplement off the market claiming it was not generally recognized as safe on the basis of the testimony of only 2 experts. So we had more than enough. And the judge acknowledged we had shown that significant disagreement existed within the scientific community as of the time we brought our lawsuit in May of 1998. But she did something tricky. Then she said, however, the critical issue here is not whether these foods are safe in 1998. Gee, most people would think, well, that is an issue. Are they? in a sense, Dr. Mercola, she tacitly conceded that as of the time we brought the lawsuit, we showed they were illegally on the market. But what she did, she said, but our main focus is, she said, that evidence basically is inadmissible. I mean, it's irrelevant. It's kind of like when the police, you know, in a criminal case, if the police obtain evidence without giving people their warnings, then it's excluded. She was basically saying, yeah, this is real concrete stuff, but I'm not going to pay attention to it. So she excluded that evidence. No manufacturer of a genetically engineered food is even required to inform the FDA before they dump that food on the U.S. market. They can put whatever they want on the market without telling the FDA, certainly without labeling it, so nobody would be the wiser. So these foods continue to be on the market illegally. They were when they were first introduced in 1992, and they continue to be now in 2015. And it's absurd that one of the nation's most important and most venerable consumer safety statutes, consumer protection laws, has been blatantly and intentionally violated by the agency that's supposed to uphold it. And they've been getting away with it all these years. And it's time to really pull the rug out from under the whole thing, because the evidence is overwhelming. All people have to do is just read it.
genetically engineered foods are a serious threat to our health, environment and our health. Hi, this is Dr. Mercola helping you take control of your health. And today we're continuing our interview with with Stephen Drucker, who has written the book, Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. But the subtitle really tells the book, which is How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. Stephen has done a wonderful job in exposing this entire fraud. And not only has it exposed it, but he's actually taken an activist role and actually sued the FDA in, I believe, 1998 for their 1992 ruling, which essentially serves as at the foundation as to how they've been able to get away with this illegal fraud that has allowed the spread of nearly a billion pounds a year of glyphosate and Roundup spread into crops around the world. There's so much information here, and I couldn't encourage you more strongly to get a copy of this book if you have any interest in this topic, because it really needs to be in your bookshelf, because it's a phenomenally historically accurate references to give you an understanding of what the problems are and how we got to the point where we are now.
The presumption that these foods are safe has been repeatedly rebutted over the years. It actually was never valid when it was made anyway, but it's been repeatedly rebutted and refuted, and yet that is the sole purported legal basis for the presence of genetically engineered foods on the United States market. The rebuttable presumption on the part of the FDA that these foods are generally recognized as safe, which, again, I cannot emphasize strongly enough, was never true when it was made. The FDA knew it was not true. They knew that neither of the necessary criteria had been fulfilled. And it's even less true today. There's far more evidence of conflict, disagreement within the scientific community. And the FDA still doesn't possess any evidence demonstrating safety, because as they themselves have admitted, they don't even do scientific reviews. And in any event, even if they did, a large number of scientists say that there is not any evidence demonstrating that genetically engineered foods are safe yet. So there clearly is not a general recognition of safety. So these foods continue to be on the market illegally. They were when they were first introduced in 1992, and they continue to be now in 2015. And it's absurd, as you have pointed out, that one of the nation's most important and most venerable consumer safety statutes, consumer protection laws, has been blatantly and intentionally violated by the agency that's supposed to uphold it. And they've been getting away with it all these years. And it's time to really pull the rug out from under the whole thing, because the evidence is overwhelming. All people have to do is just read it.
Well, and you know, it seems we have only a few options available to us, because you and your efforts to fight them legally have sort of exhausted that possibility, because you can't really sue them again for the same thing, because they won and you the appeal was, you know, basically lost, not lost, but it was just never went forward.
Right.
And the statutes on that ran out, or the time limitation. So, and then if you seek to change it through the federal regulatory agencies, as we discussed last time, that's near impossible, because it's revolving door. And the classic example, of course, is Michael Taylor, which we discussed last time. So really the only practical option we have left is to increase awareness through consumer information, so that they vote with their pocketbook and not legislatively. One of the ways that the strategies we've done this is through labeling campaigns, not so much to label them, although that's a reasonable thing, but that whole process of going through the election actually it empowers people and it makes them aware of this issue, so they become more they have a consciousness about it and are able to vote with their pocketbook and make a shift. And if you take away the demand, they're not going to produce the product, so that you don't need any regulation, which is exactly and precisely what they did in Europe.
Well, and those labeling campaigns in which you played a major role, they have really enlivened awareness among the populace in the U.S. Because before they started, the majority of consumers still didn't even realize they had been regularly consuming genetically engineered foods. So
they didn't even know what they were. I've been in a number of GMO marches, or the March Against Monsanto is what it was. And, you know, we'd be picketing and approaching people in their cars as they're passing by. And 70% of people didn't even know what they were. Yeah. It was amazing. It was just a complete lack of awareness of this.
That's how powerful the misinformation campaigns have been, or the suppression has been. Mm-hmm. But in my book, I actually mentioned, yes, increasing awareness is powerful, and it's important to increase it generally, but also, as the last chapter in my book points out, there are a few key individuals whom, if they read the book and actually understood what's been happening and how badly they themselves have been misled by scientists that they have had a right to believe we're telling them the truth, we're actually giving them sound science and presenting the full facts to them, this thing could be over very quickly. And, of course, one of those is the President of the United States, who has the power to tell the FDA to get its act together and to admit that its rebuttable presumption has been rebutted, and to require that every genetically engineered food goes through the formal food additive process, and that every one of them should be basically no longer approved for marketing until it has been demonstrated safe according to the requirements of the law. And he has the power to do that. And because all he would be doing is enforcing the will of Congress. He doesn't need to ask Congress's permission, because Congress's law has been broken by the executive branch all these years. And all he needs to do is restore the integrity of the executive branch and tell the FDA to stop breaking the law and to formally and publicly admit that it's generally recognized as safe, generally recognized as safe presumption has been solidly rebutted. And that in itself would end the whole thing. The publicity and, I think as you can tell, it would take a nosedive, a major nosedive. It's interesting, and it should have been done much earlier, and that is, we also, besides analyzing genetic engineering from the standpoint of biological science, there's another very important a field of science that is quite relevant, and that's information technology and computer science, and especially software engineering, because genetic engineers are taking very complex, huge, and very complex information systems, that's what genomes are, and they are making revisions, and in this case, radical revisions, and doing it on a very deficient knowledge base. There's so much about the genome of the plants that they are reconfiguring that of which they are unaware. And it's well known that the genomes of plants and animals are by far the biggest and most complex and most intricately interrelated information systems on our planet. They dwarf any man-made system. Bill Gates has even acknowledged that in his book, The Road Ahead. And yet, when we look at the experience of computer science and the lessons that have been learned the hard way over many years, what computer scientists have learned is, even when they themselves have designed an information system, if it gets fairly large and fairly complex, there's no way to safely revise it. No way to revise it, or I should say, no way to revise it in a way that can be presumed to be safe.
Yeah, it's like the law of unintended consequences.
That's exactly it. And even over the years, they've learned to try to insulate different components of the system from one another to minimize the risk that a change in one place will mess up something somewhere else. And they have definitely made software engineering safer and less prone to have unintended consequences. They by far have not eliminated them. So they still, anytime there's even a very minor revision to a complex information system, even made by the people who designed it and know all of the architecture, which is not the case in the genomes.
Biological, sure.
Even so, they have learned that they cannot assume that revision only changed what they wanted it to, even if it was very precisely done and very minor. they have to presume that it might have messed up something else in an unintended way. And so, especially if that program is what is called a life-critical program, one of the programs that if it were to fail is more than just an annoying crash of your word processing program. It could be a crash of a jetliner, or it could be the malfunction of an X-ray machine, or an X-ray a radiation therapy machine where people could die. And in fact, there have been fatal accidents with X-ray machines or radiation machines in which there was a small problem in revision in the computer code and people were killed because they got the wrong dose delivered. And certainly it doesn't take much imagination to know what could go wrong if there's a bug in the airplane guidance system. The plane can go down. That's why such systems, by law, first by the routine, by the practice of the industry anyway, but also by law, not only in the U.S., but in most industrialized nations, any revision made to such life-critical software systems have to go through rigorous testing after each revision, and put not only through the tests that were done beforehand, but a new battery of tests that weren't even done when that system was first approved. So it's rigorous testing. They try to test every possible parameter so that they have, as much as possible, ruled out any problem. They still can't rule it out completely, but that testing can at least make that a safe system. But there's nowhere near the same parallel kind of testing in the case of genetically engineered foods. Nowhere near it. And even the most rigorous tests that have been done on a genetically engineered food fall far short of the rigor with which life-critical software programs are tested after every revision, even by people who know much more about the system than genetic engineers know about the genomes that they're reconfiguring. And even though these software engineers may be making very precise, small revisions, whereas the genetic engineers, they basically cannot control where the packet, the new cassette of genetic information is going, of DNA is going. It's randomly inserted. It's a radical revision in several other ways. They have very little understanding about those informational systems, because after all, they didn't design them. And we know that they're far more complex and far more intricately interrelated than any human-made software is and probably ever could be. And yet they're making the assumption that they can presume that what they're doing will have only introduced the one change they want and will have not disrupted anything else in a deleterious manner. That is, from the standpoint of computer science, insanity. It's certainly reckless.
One of the questions I had after reading the book, it occurred to me, and I'm just interested in your comments on this, that invariably, at some point in the future, this is going to come to light. Now, we talked about the tryptophan issue, and it produced this eosinophilic myalgic syndrome, EMS, which killed a number of people and produced, it was very unusual symptoms, so it's easy to identify. But the complications, the side effects from consuming these foods are not going to be easy to identify. They're going to be merged in with all these other chronic degenerative diseases, and it's going to increase the death rate. But at some point, not too different, I think, than cancer, but maybe a little different because it's going to be harder to discriminate, that the truth is going to be known. They're going to do sophisticated analysis. They're going to figure this out, that it's increasing death rates. It's going to be every bit as perniciously damaging as smoking, if not more. And at some point, it'll come through. So I'm wondering, if you could – you don't really discuss in the book, but it seemed pretty obvious that there's a lot of correlations between the tobacco industry and what's going on now. So I'm wondering, especially with the massive disinformation campaigns, the lobbying politically, perverted regulatory oversight. So I'm wondering if you could – what's your comments on that?
Yes. It's good to bring out the analogies or the case of tobacco. The book does talk about use the case of tobacco, showing how difficult it is to link up ailments like cancer with a particular product. Look how long it took before we had
sure.
And people knew it appears even in the early 50s, if not earlier, that there were probably risks in smoking, but the real causal connections hadn't been put together yet with long-term epidemiological studies. And, of course, at least in the case of tobacco, it was possible, I mean, you don't need to label cigarettes. We know.
No, either you're smoking or you're not.
And people basically know how many packs a day they've been averaging. So it was possible to do the epidemiological studies because you knew who had been smoking. They could tell you when they started about how many packs a day they had been averaging for so many years. And it was finally possible to do the correlations between the cancer rates and the smoking rates. And even that took so long. In the case of genetically engineered food, epidemiologists have said there may actually never be a way to do that because they haven't been labeled in the countries in which they're being consumed to the greatest extent. They're labeled in countries where very few are on the market. And here in the United States and Canada, where they're on the market very big time, there's no labeling in either country. So it's very difficult to understand who's been eating how many for how long, because it's a real uphill battle. Genetic engineering has actually introduced a whole new level of unsustainability to agriculture. That's ethical unsustainability, because it has been continually propped up by misinformation, by twisting of the truth. And once the contortions of the truth are brought to light and straightened out, it's going to topple, because the whole foundation has been misinformation and contortion of truth. So I believe that once the light is shown upon the real facts and people understand the real situation, there can be a dramatic turnaround. Now, you know, it's possible I'm wrong, but I like to think that there's a good chance I'm right.
Well, it's from what you're saying in your comments on the epidemiological challenges of differentiating genetically modified food increases in disease, you can basically be virtually guaranteed that the future Surgeon General, like Siever Coop, is not going to come out and make some pronouncement on GMO foods. So it's going to come from us, which is really empowering, and with tools like you've created with your book, which is a massively treasure chest in itself of this information that can really topple this industry if it's put in the right hands.
You know, Americans often tend to think that the reason that the U.S. has so many GMOs permeating our marketplace and the reason that the European Union doesn't is because they've got stronger laws and stronger, more rigorous regulation, but that's not the case. As the book makes out, points out, the United States actually has the strongest food safety laws. Our laws are stronger than the EU. It's just our laws are being violated, and their laws are not being fully upheld either. The precautionary principle is supposed to be the guiding principle in European food safety law. The European Commission has emphasized that several times, but in the case of genetically engineered foods, they are not following a precautionary approach at all. They're following a very lax approach, and they have been very remiss. The European Food Safety Agency has been very sloppy, very irresponsible. As you mentioned, the book brings this out in detail. I think it's important, though, to just back up a little and understand it was primarily the European consumers becoming concerned, being transmitted some of the facts by the media before the media, even now in the last few years in Europe, I'm told the media has become a little more like our media. But in the early years, back in the 90s, in the early 2000s, the European media was very, very open to reporting problems about genetically engineered foods. They would quote scientists who were voicing concerns. That had a huge effect on the consumers. And it was the consumers that made it clear to the major grocery chains they would not buy genetically engineered food. And several major grocery chains made it clear to the manufacturers they would not buy them either because the consumers didn't want them. And that essentially stopped genetically engineered foods from getting directly into the human food chain in the European Union.
everyone watching this has the power to make a change. We are making a change. I mean, it's just a matter of collecting more and more individuals, and at some point, it's a critical mass, and they're not going to be producing this. They're going to do something else, which is ultimately going to truly serve the consumer, not killing them in their future generations or sterilizing them. So it's a good process, and it's a wonderful resource. It's just magnificent what you're able to do, and I applaud all your efforts because it's really a landmark resource that everyone who is interested in this topic really needs to acquire and spread around. I mean, this is a book that you can easily give to someone. It's relatively easy to read. It's a long book, but it's got all the information. So it's all so well documented. Phenomenal book. I can't thank you enough for putting it together. It was obviously many, many years. And that's one of the reasons why I love reading books, because literally in a relatively short time, I mean literally a few hours, you can capture the wisdom of something that someone who's working on something for decades. So, and you've really served us all well, and hopefully your book will provide a massively valuable resource that we can take it to the next level and really start to make a dent by really you showing the way and telling us that really the clear strategy that we have and we know is to be effective is to vote with our pocketbooks and to convince more and more people who are starting to get an idea. We're making a dent. We're increasing pretty much every day of the awareness of this issue that we need to avoid these foods and seek locally grown organic foods. And it's not, you know, for our health and the health of our, not only the health of our health, but our future descendants and the health of the environment. Thanks again for all you're doing. We look forward to having your book be a major success, because the more people who read it and understand it, the more of a change we're going to be able to make in this important area.
Thank you very much.